We just heard the opening music from the fifth piano concerto by Ludwig van Beethoven, nicknamed the Emperor Concerto. This particular recording featured pianist Wilhelm Kempf with the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Ferdinand Leitner. And the piece will be played by the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra Friday night at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana, featuring soloist Timothy Allen, who is on faculty at the University of Illinois School of Music, in a program that also includes The Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, a ballet by Claude Debussy, and also the Symphony in C by Igor Stravinsky, a piece that is certainly not overly often played and liable to be the least familiar piece on the program. Coming up on Live and Local, I'll be talking with Timothy Allen as he'll come into our studio. But first, we're going to have a conversation with Alan Schwab, who will be giving the pre-concert lecture Friday night at 6:30 in the orchestra rehearsal room at the Krannert Center. He's on faculty in the American Culture Studies program at Washington University in St. Louis and is a frequent pre-concert lecturer for concerts by the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. And we're very pleased to have Alan on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation. Pleasure to be here.
I think it's the second time around we've had a chance to talk in advance of one of these UI Symphony concerts.
It has. It was the opening concert from the 2011-12 season when the orchestra played the Brahms First Symphony, and it was a great pleasure to visit with audience members and with the orchestra then.
Remind me, because I've simply forgotten, what's your connection to the University of Illinois Symphony? How does somebody in St. Louis get hooked up to UIUC?
I'm an alum, and I was for a number of years on the faculty and staff at Eureka College, which is, of course, maybe an hour away, a little over an hour away drive. And so one time I simply went on the Internet and saw what the orchestra was playing. This was the better part of 10 years ago, and started commuting and driving in to hear the concerts. And this is, of course, while I was doing the pre-concert programs for the St. Louis Symphony. The I was so impressed with the work that Professor Schleicher, Donald Schleicher, and the orchestra was doing. It was so improved from what I remember hearing of the University Symphony 30 years before, when I was an undergraduate, that it was just a world of difference. And I began corresponding and visiting with Don, and he knew what I was doing, and simply invited me once to offer one of these programs, and it went very well, and got lots of nice feedback. And so it's a pleasure to come back, especially as an alumnus. I used to live in a converted family home at 1104 West Oregon, so it was one of the homes that was demolished in the two square blocks between Matthews and Gregory and Oregon and California. When the Krannert Center was built, right after I graduated in the mid '60s, and so I was teasing the folks who came to the free concert lecture a year ago that every time I come back, I look in the lobby for a plaque that says Alan Schwab slept here, and I don't see it.
You don't find one.
I've mentioned this to Don Schleicher, and he says, "Well, Alan, you keep doing a decent job with the pre-concert lectures, and I'll see what I can do."
Yeah, find out how much clout he's got, right?
That's right.
Or you've got one or the other, or both. Well, I know that you've provided some program notes for the concert on the Stravinsky piece, so I want to talk with you about
sure.
that a little bit, because it's a piece that, as I said earlier, people aren't likely to know very well. And most of your talk is going to be either directly or peripherally related to the Emperor Piano Concerto, which, of course, we'll be talking with Tim Allen about as well, at least from a pianistic point of view. So let's cover some of that, too. Why don't we start with the Stravinsky? I assume the first thing on the program is the Debussy Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, because that just seems like a sort of piece
sure.
that people would start with. And, of course, it's a landmark of music. At the time it came out, it was one of the earliest, if not the earliest, piece that got to be called impressionistic. and just stunning colors in that piece. It was to be a ballet, so it was dance. Of course, it won't be at this particular concert. And then is going to come the Symphony in C of Stravinsky.
And the Debussy, of course, also provides one of the great modern flute solo performance opportunities.
Oh, sure, right at the very opening of it.
Yeah.
So whoever the student is that is their principal for that concert is get some good practice for his or her auditions once they get around
you
to
bet.
Auditioning for orchestras. Stravinsky wrote a few symphonies of different kinds, none of which are terribly well known. What can you tell us about those, and how does this particular one fit into the scheme of what music people will know best from Stravinsky?
That's a really interesting story and way to look at it. Stravinsky wrote four pieces that are actually called symphonies. One of them is really not the symphonies for wind instruments, so-called because he's using it in the term of sounding together. But that's really more or less a piece for chamber, chamber size on ensemble. The very first symphony that Stravinsky wrote from the early years of the century, even before the Firebird, is very tuneful, very romantic, and very much in the style of what you'd expect from a student of Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov. And of course, the second symphony that he would write would be for the 50th anniversary of the Boston Symphony in 1930-1931, when he wrote the Symphony of Psalms, which is a choral group in the setting of three different psalms with a symphony orchestra. But the Symphony in C is very different from all the others, and it's different for a couple of interesting reasons. For one, it too was written on commission. It was written for the 50th anniversary of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, which would have been in the 1941-1942 season. And Stravinsky had the commission by the late 30s, and as he began work on it, writing in Paris, his family was struck down with terrible, tragic developments. Within the space of 8 months, his mother, his wife, and his daughter were all hospitalized and died from tuberculosis. And in the spring, after those terrible deaths, Stravinsky himself was stricken with tuberculosis and spent 6 months in a sanitarium and recovering, fortunately. And while he was there, he started and continued to write in 1939, the Symphony in C, and relocated first to Boston and then finally to Beverly Hills, where he lived for the greater part of his time in the United States. So one would expect that this is a work with all kinds of tragic sorts of overtones and background effects, when in fact it is sunny and transparent and colorful. And sounds, I guess if I were to characterize it in a word, buoyant might be one of them. The second important issue that grows out of the Stravinsky is that when it appeared in 1940, this was approximately 20 years after Stravinsky had shocked the musical world with the production of producing his ballet Pulcinella. That is to say, people had expected all kinds of idol smashing and hell raising from Stravinsky after the Firebird, Petrushka, Le Sacre du Printemps, a work that many people have characterized as important to the 20th century, as Beethoven's Eroica is to the 19th. And to all of a sudden, here in 1919-1920, Stravinsky's ballet after Pergolesi, called Pulcinella, neoclassic, refined, jewel-like craftsmanship, small orchestras, and sounding very much like a work written in the 18th century, not in the 20th. Well, the Symphony in C is very much in that flavor of and that characteristic of neoclassicism, very much the closest analogy I think that can be offered for it is Sergei Prokofiev's 1917 Classical Symphony, which he said was to be written and heard in the style of Haydn. If Haydn had lived another 100 years from 1812 to 1917, Prokofiev said, I wanted to write something as if Haydn would do it today. And that is some of the same spirit in which Stravinsky seems to have written the Symphony in C. And you can imagine the kind of critical and audience response that came from it. There were people who said, this is a deliberate kind of anachronism and seems a step backwards. And secondly, there were people who criticized Stravinsky for saying he has forsaken his ethnic and Russian national heritage for this neoclassic bowl of pottage, you know? And why is he doing this? And the only reasonable answer is, as I quoted from Stravinsky's journal and one of his memoirs, saying that people didn't understand that this was another step in my development, and they didn't understand, except with much better 2020 hindsight, that Stravinsky was an enormously gifted eclectic who tried on styles and tried on different periods, in other words, of musical styles, as a talented actor would try on different roles and costumes. But he always, that's the great gift that Stravinsky gives us, for being a very talented, enormously talented eclectic, he always remains Igor Stravinsky. It always comes out with characteristic kinds of qualities that we identified as Stravinskian.
Well, let's give a listen to one of the movements from the Symphony in C. There are four movements to this piece, and it's played here by the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir Colin Davis. Here's the third movement. I guess this would be sort of the equivalent of the classical minuet.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And the whole piece will be played by the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra on Friday night at the Krannert Center in Urbana, with Don Schleicher conducting. My guest is Alan Schwab, who will be giving the pre-concert talk for that concert on Friday starting at 6:30. And you're listening to Live and Local. We hear the third movement of the Symphony in C by Igor Stravinsky. The Bavarian Radio Symphony played it under the baton of Sir Colin Davis, and the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra will play it Friday night, led by Donald Schleicher, who is a music director and conductor of the U of I Symphony. That concert begins with music by Debussy, his prelude to The Afternoon of a Faun, and it will end with, sort of unusually, with a concerto. Usually concerts don't end with a concerto, but this is such a big one. Quite a symphonic piece, as well as a solo vehicle. It's Beethoven's Emperor Piano Concerto, his fifth piano concerto. It'll feature pianist Timothy Allen in the solo role. He's on the faculty at the University of Illinois. And Alan Schwab is my guest. Alan will be giving the pre-concert talk at 6:30 on Friday, and frequently gives pre-concert lectures for the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. He's on faculty at Washington University in the American Culture Studies program. And Alan, I know that your talk's going to be focusing on the idea of the piano and some of the development of the piano in Romantic piano style, culminating in the Emperor Concerto, or at least the Emperor Concerto's place in that development. And I hesitate to ask it in quite this way, but what's sort of the capsule version of that romantic development of the piano?
A couple of important things. One is size, stature, and length. Your comment is just exactly on target. This is a piece, for example, the Emperor Concerto has a first movement which is almost as long as a whole Mozart piano concerto. So there's a new stature emerging from this 1808, 1809 written piece, which premieres in 1811. That's the first important issue. The second, I think, is that to understand why Beethoven is the first important composer who never writes for the harpsichord. Why that happened is, and what impact it had on Beethoven and Beethoven had on his contemporaries is a second important issue. And I guess the third freeze-dried point that I'd want to make is that the young Beethoven, well, Beethoven was 40 when he at the premiere, is that he succeeds in turning the piano into a major concert attraction. It evolved so rapidly after that, so that by the middle of the 19th century, in the first years after Beethoven's 1827 death, and the emergence of the music of Robert Schumann and Frederick Chopin, the romantic piano virtuoso is the dominant figure of musical cultural history in the middle of the century, and of course, no figure better typifies that than Franz Liszt. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about Liszt's impact. He is the first great romantic piano virtuoso, and a touring virtuoso. He is the one who invents the modern recital, where the instrumentalist is the only performer in the for the whole evening. And his effect on audiences, and his effect on his contemporary composers.
Well, Beethoven himself was among those touring virtuosos in a less elaborate way, but
that's also important because by 1808, 1809, Beethoven was aware of the fact that his career as a touring virtuoso was over. He was too deaf to be able to play in public any longer. So while he was the soloist at a number of his earlier concertos, he knew by 1808, 1809, he couldn't do it for this piece. And that's been suggested, that's one of the reasons it lay gathering dust in the desk drawer for 2 years. He finished it in the spring of 1809. It wasn't performed until November 1811.
And do we know who performed it?
We do. I can't recall the name of the real premiere in the cultural backwater in Germany. The real premiere in Vienna was in February 1812, and that soloist was Karl Czerny, who was one of Beethoven's great students and a very talented pianist.
And the man who I'm sure many pianists today curse for all his annoying exercises that they have to play.
For Czerny's exercises. Exactly right.
Although they could be equally thankful to him for helping develop their technique. So the development of the piano at the point that Beethoven shows up with this piece, what sort of instrument were we talking about?
Well, it's one of the really interesting things to track down. I like pointing out to people that where did the name come from? The name, of course, the true name of the instrument is pianoforte, and for anybody who speaks Italian, it means soft and loud, and that's the whole point. The piano provided dynamic gradation in a way that a harpsichord and a clavicin, a virginal, and so on before that could not. In a harpsichord, however, with whatever strength and speed and impact you hit one of the keys, the sound is the same. And the development of the piano provided a new world of gradual dynamic gradation and opened up many new opportunities for performers. Now, to be sure, this didn't happen overnight, and one of the things that I do enjoy pointing out is that Mozart is only 14 years older than Beethoven, And Mozart was very aware of these developments. And Mozart's, especially his late piano concertos, are written not for the harpsichord. They're written for the fortepiano, a five-octave, smaller version of what would develop into the concert grand. And there are many people who argue today with period performance practice sensibilities that the best way to play Mozart concerti and even the early Beethoven concerti is on a fortepiano, because it has many of the characteristics of the larger, what would evolve into a concert grand. But Beethoven proved even dissatisfied with this, and by the time he is writing especially his piano sonatas, his late piano sonatas from 1816 to 1822, the concert grand has evolved and is available to him, and he uses it to very great effect. This is an instrument that would have sixth and seventh octaves instead of just five. It would be much larger, it would be much heavier, and would provide even more a kind of effects, that musical effects, that than the fortepiano could.
So the biggest difference between the fortepiano and the pianoforte, aside from the fact that they reverse the two words in their name, is essentially size.
Size and more octaves, yes.
Well, the size allows the greater number of octaves.
Yeah.
But otherwise, they both can play loud and soft. They both can vary with touch and so on. And one tends to sound fuller than the other, which can arguably sound tinny.
The concert grand piano also has third strings added for many of the keys, which it triples the tension on the frame. It doubles the instrument's weight, but it also provides the opportunity for a long lyric singing line. And more musical effects.
So how does Beethoven's Emperor Concerto exploit this new instrument?
It's fascinating with what he does, because of course what Beethoven inherits is a form with a kind of a polite orchestral sort of in the background, and providing for the soloist to show off and to provide even exhibitionist kinds of fireworks, although I doubt anyone would accuse Mozart of doing that. But what Beethoven resolved to do, as he did in so many other aspects as a musical revolutionary, was to transform the musical forms that he inherited, and in this case, to make a true partnership between the orchestra and the soloist, and I will be very interested to hear Professor Ahlen's comments on about the new partnership that Beethoven was evolving with this. He was interested in experimenting with form, obviously, for a long time, and an argument can be made that the fourth concerto, which begins dramatically different from the normal 18th century concerto, which has a long orchestral introduction followed by usually a polite entry of the soloist. Well, Beethoven simply says, "I'm not going to do that," and the fourth concerto opens up with a soft piano solo before the orchestra. And if you don't think that made audiences sit up and take notice, you would be mistaken. It obviously did. So he was already experimenting by 1804 or thereabouts with his fourth concerto, with being dissatisfied with the confinement and the boundaries of the musical forms that he inherited, just as he was dissatisfied and manipulated and refashioned and blew up in some ways sonata forms for the symphonies that he would be writing with the Eroica. So this step forward in evolution that Beethoven evidences with the key of the Emperor Concerto is logical and predictable from what we know about him and his history. By the time he writes the Emperor Concerto, he has turned out six of his nine symphonies. And he is obviously a very accomplished and dedicated revolutionary by the time he, a musical revolutionary by the time he gets to this.
What is the deal with the title Emperor Concerto? That's not a title he applied to this piece.
No, it isn't, and a lot of ink has been spilled about that. Michael Steinberg, a very fine music critic and program annotator, has written that there's a kind of sweeping, regal, majestic power and grandeur to the Emperor Concerto, which he argues was unknown to that kind of stature. He argues was unknown to any earlier a concerto. He may well be right. The issue is, though, that Beethoven raises the stature of this partnership of soloist and orchestra to a level that was just unknown before with concerti, and in many cases, in many ways, unsurpassed since.
Well, let's listen to some of the grand end of the first movement, which is, as you pointed out earlier, the larger. Well, this piece, this movement represents more than half of the whole concerto.
Right.
Of Beethoven's fifth piano concerto, nicknamed the Emperor down through the years. This is the same performance we heard earlier, pianist Wilhelm Kempf with the Berlin Philharmonic led by Ferdinand Leitner. And it'll be played by the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Donald Schleicher, featuring soloist Timothy Allen, who will be joining us very shortly here on Live and Local. And it's been my pleasure to welcome Alan Schwab in this first portion of our program. Alan will be giving the pre-concert talk at 6:30 Friday night in the orchestra rehearsal room, which is on level 2 of the Krannert Center. Just go to the elevators and look for level 2, and it'll get you. You'll find it about halfway down the hallway, two-thirds down the hall, depending upon which elevator you get off. And Alan will be talking a great deal about the development of the piano and about the piano virtuoso and of Beethoven's Emperor Concerto during that chat.
I have only one thing I wanted to add as well.
Sure.
I have a special surprise and gift for the first folks who
you do
who come. I've made some color copies of the famous 1839 portrait by Henri Lehmann of Franz Liszt. And it's a jaw-dropper. The picture is an absolutely stunning one, and it shows us why, it gives us a great hint as to why Franz Liszt was such a sensation as a performer. Of course, he was relatively unknown at that point at age 28 as a composer. So I have copies suitable for boudoir framing.
So those will go to the first number of people who show up,
sure,
or something like that?
Sure.
Well, Alan, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks very much for joining us on the show.
A delight. All best wishes, and hope to see everyone Friday night.
It was the very end of the last movement of, I'm sorry, the very end of the first movement of the final of Beethoven's five piano concertos, piano concerto number 5, nicknamed the Emperor Concerto. The pianist was Wilhelm Kempf, and the Berlin Philharmonic was conducted by Ferdinand Leitner here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly, and on the program coming up, we'll have the pianist who will be playing that piece with the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra in just a couple of days at the Krannert Center in Urbana. Support for our broadcast today comes from the iHotel and Conference Center in Champaign. Along with 48 double queens, 76 single kings, and 2 suites, the iHotel features custom-designed furnishings and commissioned artwork through 40 North 88 West. More information is at stayattheeye.com. It's time to donate your CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment to the vintage vinyl sale to benefit Illinois Radio Reader. Just take your donations of used CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment to any Busey Bank office in Champaign, Urbana, Savoy, or Mahomet, or to the sale site itself at 40 East University Avenue in Champaign. For more information, call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503. Timothy Allen is Associate Professor of Piano at the University of Illinois School of Music, and he will be the soloist with the U of I Symphony conducted by Donald Schleicher on Friday night, the concert that starts at 7:30, which will include also music by Debussy and Stravinsky. And he's with us this portion of the program. Tim, thanks very much for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
You've got kind of a close relationship with Beethoven at the moment because you've been involved in a project to record all the Beethoven piano sonatas, which, of course, is pretty monumental. Are the concertos likely to figure in there at any point, or is hiring an orchestra a whole other project?
That would be wonderful. I would love to play all the concertos. But, yes, as you mentioned, the practicality of it presents certain challenges. So I would need an orchestra.
Yeah, and I guess in the days of these days of recordings get done, at least in the classical world, you'd probably have to pay that orchestra yourself because the recording company's going to do it. So tell me about what one gets from playing the piano sonatas in preparing to play one of the piano concertos or any of the piano concertos. How much does the language transfer? How much does the whole sensibility transfer?
Well, the question of what one gets from working on the sonatas is a huge question in itself, regardless of how it relates to the concerto specifically. I mean, certainly there's a relationship between the styles, because the early concertos were written, you know, at the beginning of his career, and the fifth was written near the end, going into the later period. So you see the development, even within the five, of his compositional, creative, his maturity developing. The fourth and the fifth concertos in particular are, in a way, I guess you could say, the some of the ultimate expressive challenges for the musician. So, and naturally, some of the later sonatas, it's the same situation. So, I mean, there's plenty of relationships between them.
What makes those two concertos expressively challenging?
Well, boy, there's a lot to say about that, but I guess first of all, the fourth concerto in G is completely different from the fifth, the Emperor in E flat. The fourth concerto is, I guess you could call it, sublime, lyrical, expansive, and deeply personal. But the fifth has this element of virtuosity to it that makes it stand out probably amongst all concertos written to that point. But nevertheless, this virtuosity is not gratuitous at all. I mean, it's very organic. It's, for example, even in the recapitulation of the first movement, the opening cadenza returns intact in the Emperor Concerto. So it's not that all that arpeggiation and octaves and scales and everything were just there to show what the pianist can do. It's part of the structure of the piece. I mean, there's so many elements of these. I mean, there's such wonderful, great pieces, it's hard to know where to start. But I guess my point right now is that they're completely different. The same is true with the sonatas. He never wrote the same sonata twice, even though he wrote at least 32 solo sonatas. Each one of them has its own unique character, personality, compositional aspects. So in that sense, working on them is a constant searching or quest for discovering the true nature and really what he meant in his composition.
So there's at least a couple of categories of challenge, it sounds like, coming back to the concertos and specifically the Emperor Concerto, one of which is the technical aspect of it. You said, you know, this one is perhaps more virtuosic, which makes one assume that it's hard to play in many ways, just technically speaking, but then also to figure out, well, how to express it musically and maybe how to turn some of that technical technicality into
Something sounds bright and has a lot of notes doesn't necessarily mean that it's more difficult to play. In fact, you could even make an argument that the opposite is true, that the subtlety of the fourth concerto requires even more control, even more depth of understanding and connection to the phrasing and the sound and the subtlety of harmonic changes, etc. I mean, the dynamic control. So, but yes, even though Emperor does have this effect of expansive brightness and exuberant quality, in particular in the first and the third movement, the third movement also has a wonderful dance-like nature to it. And the syncopations in the opening theme are especially gripping and give it a special character, which is something that Beethoven likes to explore. So the accents don't happen in the expected places on the beats. In fact, that opening idea, he compresses the rhythm that starts, da 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 da, and then after that, da 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 da. So he has eighth notes followed by sixteenths, ending with an accent in the so-called wrong place, which gives it a real lift and a real flair and a dance-like quality.
Well, we'll hear a little bit of that last movement coming up. I also wanted to play some of the opening of the second movement, which is a really, I mean, you made reference to the fourth concerto as being perhaps especially emotionally expressive and personal, but this second movement of the fifth is certainly very beautiful. But I also wanted to kind of pick up on something Alan Schwab said earlier, because he actually said, I'd be interested to hear Tim Allen's take on something he talked about, which is what he called the new partnership between the soloist and the orchestra, sort of as expressed in this concerto, where the orchestra becomes much more of a player than it used to be in piano concertos, where, you know, formerly the orchestra would sort of sit back a little bit, noodle around, and let the soloist shine. I'm exaggerating, of course, grossly, but with this concerto, not so much, and this second movement starts with something that purely belongs to the orchestra.
Right, and I think that this tradition, though, goes back to Mozart, at least, definitely, because in those concertos, you have also a lot of interplay between the soloist and the orchestra and the individual woodwind players, for example. And you certainly get that in the Emperor Concerto. But the second movement of the Emperor is very close to my heart. It's deeply expressive, deeply personal. But one thing I'd like to point out about that, the piano solo entrance starts with a very high note, and then it gradually descends, although it doesn't descend straight down stepwise. It has expressive turns back up and then continues on its way down, and several of those on the way down. And I am convinced, in a way, that Beethoven is exploring the idea of the universal quality as opposed to the personal quality, that there is this almost Kantian aspect of the moral law within versus the starry night or the starry sky. So he's in a way, by hearing that very high note, it conjures up in my mind the image of a star. And then you have that several times. So you have the sense of of looking up into the vast expanse of the universe. And then as the music descends down and is very warm and expressive, you have the relationship of the personal aspect juxtaposed with that. So I think Beethoven, being the idealist that he was, is expressing this dichotomy between the personal and the universal. And it's interesting that Schumann, in his fantasy, Opus 17 for solo piano, in which he was paying an homage to Beethoven, he actually imitates this idea in the third movement. It starts with that same very high note and then the same melodic contour coming down in several times. And even the second time that that happens, he even uses the same key area that Beethoven uses for the second statement. So I think that this is an idea that appealed not just to Beethoven, but it inspired Schumann in that fantasy.
To do something similar. Well, here is the opening portion of the second movement of Beethoven's Fifth Piano Concerto. This is a recording that features pianist Rudolf Serkin with the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Bruno Walter. And Timothy Ellen is my guest. He's going to be playing the concerto with the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra Friday night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana. Sort of ending with an example of what Tim Allen was talking about, where the piano goes to a high point and descends from there, sometimes gradually, sometimes precipitously, and played here by Rudolf Serkin with the New York Philharmonic, led by Bruno Walter, the second movement of the Fifth Piano Concerto of Beethoven, which Tim will play with the U of I Symphony on Friday night at the Krannert Center. Concert that starts at 7:30. This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available, and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309. The time has really escaped very, very quickly. Just really, really briefly, Tim, when you're getting with an orchestra, for the first time on a piece like this. And I don't imagine you get too many chances to play with orchestra. What's the dynamic like right away? You know, are you immediately presented with a challenge of ensemble, or is that grow pretty organically for this particular piece?
I think even though we're working on a piece that probably everyone has heard at least several times, it's always a challenge when you have that many players getting together the first time, in terms of, you know, not just the piano with the strings, but all the woodwinds, the brass. There's a timpani solo right before the coda of the final movement, even in the Emperor Concerto. So there is that ensemble challenge that comes just from hearing things the first time. I can imagine what it was like at Beethoven's time. You know, the first performance was given by his student Czerny, and it was said to be a wonderful debut, a premiere performance. But I can only imagine what it was like to hear these very novel sounds the very first time, you know, without the benefit of recordings or anything such as that. Because, you know, we experience the same feeling of freshness and challenge, even working on the piece now.
Well, it's just an absolutely fabulous piece of music, of course, and you're lucky to get a chance to play it, and the orchestra is lucky to have a chance to play it with you. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate your coming in and talking with us a little bit about it. Again, that concert starts Friday, 7:30, music by Debussy and Stravinsky on the first part, and then the Beethoven Emperor on the second part of that concert. Our program today is made possible also by the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting trumpet phenom Alison Balsam and the Scottish Ensemble on Thursday, April 18th at 7:30 p.m. in the Follinger Great Hall. For more information, visit krannertcenter.com or call 217-333-6280. This is 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois.